What's the plan?
Just to ride and show you some of the areas, the countryside. And to kind of like give you a vision of how it used to look back in the day when you, I think you guys are interested in. Mm-hmm. According to the letter, you wanted to do, your information is based on pre-civil rights area or civil rights era. Mm-hmm. In the South and some of the changes that had taken place.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it give you a visual from my perspective of what some of the changes that took place as far as the landscape, you know. It kind of help you out some.
Today is November 5th, Benny Brown in Jonestown.
Ride through this area here, you see like this land, you don't see any houses, but this area here, maybe from it used to be dotted with houses sitting out across the field, houses sitting out here, you know, you from here down to the curve, and you might have 10 houses that were sitting out. Mm-hmm. Because people were sharecroppers, and each family, these areas out here were communities, you know, because families had, they farmed maybe 40 acres of land before the farm became mechanized, and they moved to another system, you know, before people moved out of these country areas. And so, you know, this is why now you see no houses now. There's some of the changes that have been made in this area here. Because the farm are more mechanized now, so they don't have the sharecroppers. So, yeah, when I was in school, we had a house here and a house there. Next to each one of these poles, you probably had a row of houses right along here. I remember the row of houses on this side that people lived in, you know. So, most of these people either moved into town or they just moved away. After, during the 60s, you saw a lot of people moving out of the Delta, headed north to Chicago and Detroit and other areas, you know, because there was the hope of better opportunities there.
What type of jobs did the people that stayed in Jonestown have?
Well, they worked on these farms. This cotton wasn't picked by machines, it was hand-picked.
Well, after you said the mechanization.
After the mechanization, most of them still continued to work on the farm, because they were involved in the steel farming, you know. So the cotton kind of, they still use the cotton pickers. But the cotton was usually, it was packed. The picker would come and unload the cotton, and so they would pack it by foot and hand. And so people were still using it. And then they came up with another system where they had what they call modules, where they would put the cotton into a system like with those bales out there. See those things out there?
Mm-hmm.
They put the cotton into that, then they would pack the cotton, more bales into it, what they call bales into those, and then they would just leave it out there and then have a truck to come pick it up. But until then, they used trailers, which were system by which the cotton pickers unloaded the cotton into the trailer, and they carried it back there to the gin. So you would have these gins ginning all night, ginning cotton. And you had people working at the gins also. The oil mill in town has always hired a lot of people. The place, I don't know whether you guys saw the oil mill.
Mm-hmm.
There've always been a lot of employment there, especially this time of year when they were picking cotton. A lot of students who were 16 and over, we used to work at the oil mill at night, you know, to make an extra income during the school year. I just got your ass.
When did mechanization take place here?
It began to really take place after the after 68, after Dr. King was killed. It was taking place slowly, but I think it became a necessity after Dr. King was killed. Dr. King was killed because of the increase in the minimum wage. People were making $3 a day as far as chopping cotton, as far as 1967, I know. People made $3 a day, 12 hours a day. That's how we work from 6 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock in the evening. And we're paying $3 a day, all day long, to chop cotton. And picking cotton, you made something like 35 cent a hundred, or 35 cent a pound. So that's a 15 cent a pound, I think, is how much it was then. So you can make a little more, but it was still not comparable to having a minimum wage, you know. And so after Dr. King was killed in 68, and the minimum wage was made a law, then mechanization really began to pick up, because farmers didn't want to pay that minimum wage. It was cheaper for them to buy the machines that was necessary to do the work than to pay a minimum wage. See, there was a house sitting there that a big farmer used to have, with houses sitting all around in these areas. And so, you know, we haven't passed the house since we left Jonestown. But I guarantee you, 40 years ago, we would have passed 40 houses where family lived. So families live all in this area. You see, like, you ride through this area, you see a church. You say, well, why is a church sitting here by itself? Because people still come out here to worship. And years ago, all down in there were houses. So you had the population to support a church there. Mm-hmm. So the church hasn't moved, but the people have. You know, the population of people have moved.
Did any of these communities have names? Or were they just, you know, rows of houses?
Well, most of them were recognized by the plantation. Say, for instance, back there, the area I pointed to was the Stewart Plantation. Mm-hmm. This area up here was known as the Longino Plantation. Now, this area here, from this house, this brick house here, all the way back to this building over there, and on this side, is known as Swan Lake Association. Now, the Swan Lake Association is a Baptist association, which is made up of 17 churches. These 17 churches back in, this association was formed back in 1873, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was 8 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. And this association was formed by this group of black churches within this county here in Quitman County, in order to put together scholarships to further help educate the newly free black children who were beginning to go to school and come off the farm. Now, this land belongs to them here. All this land belongs to the association on this side. If you look at it in the area view, you see a little patch of land over in the middle of a whole lot of land. But this is black-owned land still. Now, all of this land, some of this land back here we just passed, used to be owned by black people. But it was taken away during the Depression when black people couldn't afford to pay taxes. Or some of them just absolutely ran off of their land. You know, they were just given an ultimatum. Either you leave or you die. And a lot of people left land that they owned because in order to save their lives. Because back then, you know, if white people wanted your land, they just took it. And that's what happened. But we've been blessed to save this land here. This land here is still, we own 204 acres. Swan Lake Association owns 204 acres. This is our building here. This Swan Lake Missionary Baptist Association. This is our central building. We sold land back in the early 70s, as people began to need places to live, we began to sell land, and a lot of people bought lots out here. They lotted it off. People bought lots in order to build homes or to set their mobile homes. And so this is land that we sold because the white farmers don't sell land. They got plenty of, it's plenty of land around us, but none of it's for sale. And so that's why you'll see people able to buy homes because nobody's selling any land. This is the building that we put on this particular property here. And this is our Swan Lake Central building. But all of this land used to be farmland. In fact, this was my family farm. My family farmed this land. I grew up in that house right there. But before it was changed around, somebody bought the property. That's the house I grew up in. And all this used to be an area that we farmed. You know, I come from a family of 14. And we farmed this land here. This is where we farmed. This was our, we planted beans over here and cotton over there. We had a garden. We had a hog pen where we raised our own meat. We had a pasture for our cows and that we had our own milk. And so that's how people survive, because a lot of the things that they ate, they produced them themselves. And they raised a lot of things themselves. You know, we didn't go to the store for milk or stuff like that, you know. And up until, to the time that we moved into Jonestown, which was like 1968 probably, we lived there. And we had an outside toilet. That's what we had there, an outside bathroom and everything, even in 68. And see, all houses was all out here. Our neighbors, we played ball in this area here. And so this is what we, with this land, we were able to farm with this land a little better, make a little more than we did on the plantation, because, you rented land and you weren't on the sharecropper system. You rented the land from Swan Lake Association, and you paid them a fourth of all the income that you made. And so this part of the land is some right, it's a move it across that bayou there. So all that land through there belongs to Swan Lake Association. And so this church here, it sits down here. This church here was established probably around 1856, I think they have said it.
Wow.
It was. Or farther back. I mean, this is towards.
The same church, or has it moved?
It hasn't moved. I think it burned once, but it hasn't moved. When Swan Lake first started the association, they had a school down here also. They used to have a school down here, which, and a dormitory that they were. If you went before the 8th grade back then, they gave you a certificate and you were able to teach. That's the most education that a black person need. And so the teachers, when I started school, most of them didn't have anything but an 8th grade education, because they come out of this school down here. And so this church was one of the founding churches in the Swan Lake Association. And so they...
built before slavery ended.
It was here before slavery. It has continued to exist. It's not a full time, what I mean, four Sundays a month. But they do operate and do meet maybe one Sunday out of the month. People come down here to worship, you know. And so this is where we came to church, because we lived up there. We used to walk to church down here, you know.
So how many people were part of Swan Lake Association?
How many people? Well, there were 17. There's 17 churches in the association.
I mean, how many people rented land?
It was always probably about 10 families that rented the land on this side. It's 200 acres here, 204 acres here, and before they built those houses there, it was like 255 acres. They used 51 acres to build those houses. And so it was like 255 acres, so it was about 10 families that rented land.
When was the organization founded?
The organization founded around 1873, about 8 years after the end of slavery. And this land was bought. They bought land around, I think they had bought this land around 1932. But from here, from this point, from that point back there where I showed you this land was, mm-hmm. all the way to where we're going, the way we're going now, all this land here used to be owned by black people. All of it. We own none of it now. There's about 200 acres over in that area there that the guy who lived in that house there still owns. His family still owns it. He rented out. But black people lost this land, or it was taken from them back in the 30s. And this, according to some people I've talked to.
And why was there like this upsurge in the 30s of, I guess, whites taking land away?
It has something to do with the depression.
Oh, okay.
Mortgage due, you know, money was due because people had borrowed money in order to farm and them not being able to pay the money back, or they weren't given the opportunity to pay the money back, you know. Relief didn't come, you know, like now that a bailout is going, nobody was even bailed them out. You know, once their land was mortgaged off and they couldn't come, and they went to the bank and they didn't have the money for that year's when they had borrowed money to farm, and they didn't have the money, the bank would just take the land. Or, like I said, some people just ran off of their land.
So, I guess a Swan Lake Association, but an alternative to sharecropping?
It was an alternative to sharecropping. We moved on the Swan Lake Association. My family did, my father. We moved there in 61. John Kennedy was elected president, I think, in 60. And we moved there in 61. And it was always, he always felt like it was a hope for better, for doing better once we moved there. Because we moved off the plantation. You know, at that particular time in 61, we were staying on the plantation, which we're going to go by there and see that. And so it gave you more opportunity to make more money. It still was stressful, I guess, because you, now that you had your own, you had to produce, to the point where you didn't have the equipment to work with, you know, you're still too poor to buy a tractor or some of the other equipment that you need to work with. So it was always, you know, just still stressed out trying to make it. Now, this time of year, when cotton was in the field, when I was 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, maybe 9th grade, we wouldn't even go to school. But this time of year, between September and the end of the year, because most of the time, before the pickers came, it became mechanized, it would take people the whole fall season to get this cotton out of the field. You know, just picking it by hand. And so I would miss something like 3 to 4 days a week out of school in order to help on the farm. We would take turns going to school, you know, because we couldn't go to school every day. We had to be in the fields to get the cotton out. And so, you know, that...
And around what time was this?
This was always between... probably September 1st and the first of the year.
And what year was this?
This was like, this went on constantly until probably about 1968.
Okay.
Probably about 1968.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, what'd you say?
That's a little graveyard back there. Do you know what that was?
No, that's not a graveyard.
I mean, like way back, in the forest.
Yeah, that graveyard back there is, you see the little farm we passed on the side? That's that family's graveyard. See, every now and then you'll find a little patch of land that black people were able to hold on to. The house that sits over there. That family, the Jones family, I've been knowing them. Their family has about 40 acres in there. Most of the time when you find black people with land in these areas, about 40 acres. Now, I don't know whether they, at some we originally got granted that 40 acres and a mule or what, but that's just about what most of them have. He got 40 acres. So he just look at 40 acres of land that belongs to a black person in the middle of all this land. Now, all this land used to belong to one of the founders of the association by the name of Silas Kelly. And he not only started the association, but he had a store and a funeral home also. And he lost all of this land because of the depression.
Generation to generation by blacks?
For instance, that back then has been passed down generation to generation. Oh. Yeah. The young man who stays there still, you know, most of his family, he lives there. I'm saying most of his family has migrated early. Mm-hmm. Most children who came up during the time I came up, they left home when they were 18 years old. They'd had enough. If you stayed to the point where you came 18, you left because opportunities for school came with affirmative action, and that happened after Dr. King. All this was pre-civil rights. There was no opportunities. You know, you were kind of forced to bring your children out of school to make them work on the farm because, you know, the man want to know what. Why would you send your kids to school? They don't need school. It wasn't a necessity. Most white farmers didn't feel like you should send your kids to school. This cotton was more important than black children being educated. And so that's the sacrifice that families made for their children is to work the farms. And a lot of you know, you wonder why some of the ignorance still. The ignorance is still going on is because of that. You know, you still got generations who still haven't had a college graduate in the family. And I would say that there are a few that you might not have a high school graduate still around this area because, you know, that's how deep it ran. The education became unimportant. And so it was never stressed. And so it took some generations for children to break the cycle. And some families, the cycles were never broken. That cycle of ignorance. But you see, we haven't passed the house since we left down by the church and saw that White House, you know, except over in there. And it was houses all up and down the road, it was houses.
So did they all move to Jonestown, or?
These people just moved to some of these small towns around, you know. Mm-hmm. Or they just left the area. A lot of them left the area, you know. That's what I'm saying, the children were leaving all the time. And so since the children were leaving, most of the time they left mom and dad, and mom and dad died. People just didn't come back.
When was the height of the migration? From Mississippi.
It was part of the migration from Mississippi.
Right, but when was the height of that for this area?
Well, as far as I can tell, I've heard some people say it was in the early 50s, but I still saw a lot of it when I was going to school. I saw families moving away. Up until the time that I finished high school in 71, and that's when it began to really just stop. After that, everything began to slow down after 68, after the Civil Rights Bill was passed. And after people began to, after schools began to open up, more emphasis was put on education. Affirmative action began to open doors for black students to become educated. And there were more scholarships available, you know. And that's when you had a trend, more or less, that children wouldn't be leaving home. And most of the time, you know, like in the summers, when I was in 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade, I went to Chicago to find summer work because I didn't want to be on the farm during those summer. Those years I rebelled against the farm. I no longer want to be on the farm during the summer. I no longer want to work in the field. I had relatives in Chicago, so that's why I went. That's where I went for the summer in order to find work.
How much would it cost to go up to Chicago?
Man, you could go to the train station over in this town, Batesville, to the bus stations. When David's school was out, the station would be full of people headed north to find work. And they would come back after the summer, you know. And so it would cost, I think then, $12 for a ticket, you know, to ride the train. Maybe $10 for a ticket to ride the bus, you know. And you always had people who would come down for graduation. And you even had guys who would come down and get a load of people and take them back to Chicago because they would get some type of incentive or bonus if they brought people back to the areas to work, you know. And they would come down and get people, you know. So you had a lot of that going on. But this little town here, Beeland, this was the little area that we used to come to when I was a child, you know, between the ages up to the age of 6 years old. That's where we would come to do our trading for what things we did buy, sugar and what clothing was available. He had white store owners who would offer some type of credit to people who would go there and buy stuff, you know. And they would pay at the end of the year when they settled the crops. So all these areas back here. Now this is pretty close to the area that I was born and raised back here. And like I said, all these areas had houses everywhere. When I ride through here, I think about all of the houses that used to sit along here. This was like a road here back in there. There was houses all along there in front of the bayou. And people used to go out here and fish and everything, you know. This town. This is what they were doing, fishing that bayou. It's a spot down there where churches used to have baptism, where people would be baptized. We baptizing these waters.
How often do baptisms take place?
Probably most churches, they would have revival. And within a 2-week period, all the churches in a certain area would have a revival. So they would do it together, you know. So there would be like maybe once a year, once or twice a year, that they would hold a baptism. All along this area here were houses.
When you were in Chicago over the summers, where would you stay?
I had sisters, I had family in Chicago. My sisters and brothers who had left earlier. I come from, like I said, a big family of 14. And if you think about what I said about people leaving home when they're early. Mm-hmm. And so my sisters and brothers left home even earlier than 18. My oldest brother, he probably left home when he was 16 years old to just get away from the fields. And my sister, she probably left when she was 16. And my oldest sister's brother, they left when they were 16 years old. And the next group of sisters and brothers, they probably left after they finished high school. The last group, I would say the ones from my age on down. When I left home, I went into the service. I was in my second year of college, and I decided to join the Air Force. Now my brother, who's under me, he went on to finish at Alcorn, and my brother, who's younger than him, he went on to finish at Ole Miss. See, things had really opened up then. You know, when that window was open, where they was getting affirmative action was really doing the job that it was supposed to do. Children could get into school and you know, and they could kind of make up for the time that was lost. And my youngest sister, she went to Delta State, so and one sister older than me, she finished at Jackson's thing. So the doors, they really began to open up. And we were taking advantage of them.
So how many people from this area joined the Air Force or the Army or something?
Well, most of them didn't. Most of these people, most of the people I know who before Vietnam started, you had your draft, so a lot of them were being drafted out of school. Now, the brother was drafted out of school. And so, during the draft, a lot of young guys from this area went in because they had a system, even at the courthouse, where they were giving deferments to white boys. Black guys were being given 1A status. Yeah. They were being shipped off to Vietnam, straight to Vietnam, within 3 months from the time they went into the service. I mean, it was just set up like that. That's the way they had it. It was so unfair, you know. The way they did things, you know, the way they played with people's lives, but that's what they were able to do. And it was, you know, they were called on it, but nobody ever I guess nobody ever had the answer for it as far as going to court. But you know, they knew it was unfair. They knew what was happening. And they were being pulled out of school. These young guys were being pulled out of school. And that was because now the doors had opened up. So we have to have a way to kind of still not let you move too fast, far too fast. And so that was the way of doing it. A lot of other things began to happen in the community that we didn't understand. And, you know, just once the doors opened, a whole lot of things came to the doors, including drugs. This area here, this, you see, that's what we call, that's a pecan orchard there. That was one of the ways that we made extra money. We would go out there and pick up pecans this time of year and sell them back to the lady who had the pecan orchard. Go out there and just hustle and make some money.
How much would you get paid for that?
25 cents a pound, I think we made on pecan. Maybe 10 cents a pound then, though. Because not very much, you know, but you made enough to kind of have you some extra money to walk to the store. Now, this was Peterson. This is the area I was born in. This is my perspective. It's where my life began, in this area here. Peterson Plantation. And my father worked on this plantation. There's a house sitting right there on the hill. There's another house sitting right here on this hill. There's houses all across there. You know, there's a tree there sitting in front of a house. There was houses dotting all of this area here. All of this area here was a bayou.
But did all these houses disappear?
People no longer. Most of these farms now rent out to other farmers. So they have no need for keep people who are sharecroppers. Mm-hmm. All the people who stayed on these farms and these houses were sharecroppers. There's no need for a sharecropper now. So the houses are gone. These people don't need anybody on their plantation. This was a plantation. It was a house sitting right here that I was born in. Sitting right here in this spot here. See, it's gone. Another house sitting back over behind where my great grandmother lived. House is over there near that, where those the woods are. House is sitting all back in that area there. And this county here, this Quitman County. Quitman County was the poorest county in the nation at the time that I was born. Quitman and Tunica County up north where the casinos are. These were two of the poorest counties in the nation.
Wow.
there was new opportunities, and the schools were just bad. They hadn't really, the case of Brown versus the Board of Education had been to court, but it hadn't been legislated. So nobody had come to make sure that black children had equal access to education. And so nobody really cared. Now, right through there was a church sitting over there. Right through there across that wood. There was a little bridge sitting there that we could go through. It was a church sitting over there. And that's where I started the school.
At the church?
At the church. And it was a one-room school. And that was I was born in 53, so you say 59, 60. 57, 58, 59, 60. So I was 6 years old. It was a one-room school. And all the classes were held in, it was two rooms. Two rooms downstairs, two rooms upstairs. That's where the school was, a block school. There's two rooms upstairs, two rooms downstairs. And they housed grades 1 through 8. Eight grades were in those four rooms. And if that school burned one day, when I was about 6 years old, and I remember when it burned, they moved the classes into the church. And so it was like an open bay school after that. Until they finally changed. It was mandated that the state of Mississippi had to come to par with the Brown versus Board of Education decision. And so after that happened in 1960, they closed that school, and we moved to we didn't move, but the buses began to pick us up and take us to Marks, which is about 15 miles from here to school. And I was second grade when the first year I went there. And I stayed there until the middle of my third grade year before we moved to Johnstown. And so this, you know, you can imagine what teachers had to deal with. Some kids were 9 years old in the second grade. Because it wasn't a mandatory kindergarten or pre-education. And then they had to miss 40 to 50 days out of school because they were working on the farm. Some of them never learned to read. You understand what I'm saying? Some of them never learned to read.
And what year is this?
This was like when they moved these schools to Mark. It was like 1960. It was mandated that they had to close all these church schools and either integrate or make schools acceptable for black children. And so what they did, they put more money into the build schools that were still didn't come up to par, you know, but this would satisfy the federal law and buy some time until we, you know, do what we want to do. At least because there was no pressure on them to do it, you know. But this, the Brown versus Board of Education was in 53, 55? 1955 or 53? 55. So look how many years it took them to even try to do something. It was 4 years before they even say, okay, we're gonna obey the law. You know? 4 years before they still fought against it, you know.
Was there ever any kind of white on black violence here?
White on black all the time, yeah. I mean, I remember my daddy coming home back in probably a year that Kennedy was elected, and he had tears in his eyes because he wasn't allowed to vote. He wasn't allowed to vote that year. And so, you know, but I remember a police coming to our house when my sister, we used to go to church over at this church and drive around here to church. She had gone to another church, which was back then, and a policeman, that's one of the policemen out of Marks, that stopped him for driving on a gravel road, man. And he wanted to take her to jail, but he was going to come and pick her up that night. And so my daddy refused to let her go. And he wanted to take her by force. But my mother had slipped out of the house and gone down to the plantation owner's house and let him know what was going on. And he came to the house and stopped this man from taking my sister away. But there was always the fear that you couldn't go too far away from home. Or you had to be always careful what you said. Or your parents were always afraid of that something could happen to you. So they always monitor where you were, and that's why they didn't feel bad about a child leaving home at the age of 16. At least they knew that they might be safer in even in Chicago or in the city than they were in the South, being rebellious or not working, you know. If you wasn't working, you know, like you see guys now not working, they walking around, you couldn't get away with that, because these folks were just, they were so crazy then. If you weren't working and you walked around and they saw you a couple of times, then you might end up missing. There's so many people who ended up missing in these areas that you know, it's hard to even probably keep count. People just were scared to say anything, afraid to tell somebody what had happened to them, you know. And the story probably just stayed within the confines of the plantation. You know, so many stories that just never got out.
Do you remember any examples?
No, not personally do I. But I've always heard. My father was real protective of us. Mm-hmm. We didn't go hunting. We didn't go. If we went fishing, we didn't go no further than right in the area that we lived. And he was very, 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 very protective of us. And he kind of kept us shielded from a lot of stuff. But you know, you were here, things happening in Marks, somebody getting shot. The police shot somebody on a Saturday night or something like this. You'd always hear about it, you know. People wouldn't discuss it as much in front of children, because it was, like I said, my father was protective of us. But if you're around, you know, other people, you get a, you hear him talking about it. Yeah. Like I said, the church, now we're across that bayou. The church sits right over there in that area. That's where it sits. But the hurricane came, tornado came through. I think it was in 2002 and blew that church down. But all the children from these plantations went to school there. That's where we went to school. All the these plantations, from the time we passed the little town and turned off, all down in here, all back up that way, all these kids went to school right there. And so you had one little four-room school. And at the peak of, I guess at the peak when kids could come to school, you might have 200 children or more. You might have 200 children. Some of these, you know, children in the end, they, like I said, they never did finish. No more than 8th grade, 9th grade. And then they left home.
Is that black on white, that white on black violence? And hearing stories of disappearances and things like that,
yeah.
You know, what would that do to black psychologically? Like, what would that do to you?
Well, you know, you still go through it, because I mean, I guess that's part of your orientation. And when it becomes part of your orientation, sometimes you don't know what effect a thing have on to you until you just kind of do a self-analysis. I noticed this morning, for instance, I have a lot of white customers who come in here for dinner. Mm-hmm. And I noticed how subdued they were, and how my joy was somewhat, I had to, you know, mask my joy. And I'm saying, why am I masking my joy? And that's what I'm saying. I began to think, okay, this is still part of the orientation, that I can't be joyful, about this country having its first black qualified president, a man who's qualified to do the job, because I don't want to offend people who are not as joyful about it as I am. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? So it's still there. Because that's the way you orientate, so it don't leave. If you know what I'm saying.
Oh yeah.
So it don't leave. So. The bus route, when I was in school, the bus would go across there. It's a whole another plantation. Barksdale. That was a plantation. Now this land here, my mother told me we had relatives who used to own all of this land here. They were literally ran up off the land. They used to own all this land here. That's the house that they lived in.
When were they ran off the land?
This was before the 50s. Because, you know, in talking to my mother, she used to always tell us a story about it, you know. And so I was, like I said, I was born in 53 and I always heard that story. So it had to happen before I was born, sometime in the late 40s, you know, when that happened.
Do you remember the specifics of the story?
She told me about that. I don't remember it really in specifics. Just told me they got ran off, you know. Sometimes when you ask your parents about a little more than that, you know, they kind of don't even want to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, something that they don't kind of discuss. And so I guess I just didn't pursue the specifics of what Association. And all these blacks here own their own land, and it's probably been in the family for some years.
So this is all black out here?
Oh yeah. Probably all the land from here on this side all the way back, not on this side.
So considering that so many, I guess, disappearances weren't even reported, how many do you think were not reported versus were reported?
I'd say for every I just feel like for every one that was reported, there's probably 3 to 4 that wasn't reported. Wow. I really feel like that. Because I don't think people really start reporting a lot of things that happened to them after. They felt safe enough to talk about it. You know, even this morning I was talking to my brother-in-law, and he was telling me about how his grandfather, back in one of the smaller towns, right, Jonestown, was taken away by these white people, because when he went to this lady's house, this white lady's house, she was laying on the floor, and that she had a seizure, and they thought that he had raped her, and they took him because she was unconscious. They went straight to his house and got him and beat him up, and he died 2 days later. And when she came to, I guess she went into a coma or something, she told them that he didn't touch her. She, because she worked for her, he did not touch her, but he was already dead.
Why is there such a fear that, you know, blacks would rape whites?
So what now?
Why do they have such an irrational fear that, you know, every black man would rape a white woman?
This is what's been instilled in them. They were raised feeling like that. Mm-hmm. They were raised feeling that black people were a beast, that we were some type of inferior animal, that we really weren't human. And they even had scientists, science on their side, as far as some scientists who had done studies and come up with this smaller brain and all this old crazy stuff. And they taught this is what they taught their children. They raised them to be ignorant and prejudiced, and that's the way they were raised. You know, and this is just not a Southern thing. It was all over. It was just more prevalent in the South. And you know, and I guess this white lady in the South was always looked at this genteel creature. That was that the black man desired, and that he had to put her honor was to be protected, you know, above all things. And I think that's the way it was.
How much time we got left?
7 minutes.
Right. And we'll switch the tape after that.
Okay.
Just no more tape. Got this.
There's anything key that you want me to get on tape?
Mm-hmm.
There's 1 separate minute. Just keep recording all
time. If there's anything else you want to show us, it's important that we can tape it with a video camera. Otherwise, we can just audio record it.
Okay. Yeah, we just hear it back. See the rest of his name now. Yeah.
And this is all still black?
Yeah, all this is still black. All of this. These are people who are able to hold on to it.
Are there any stories from, I guess, the time of slavery or Reconstruction that have been passed down through generations that you've heard?
It was this one story that my mother used to always tell us all the time about this guy who was, this black guy who they hung. He was innocent of, hey, now! And they accused him of raping a white woman in Marks. And when they, it was waiting to carry him to trial, when a group of white men went to the jailhouse and took him out, and they hung him. And she was just, she used to always tell how the day that they hung him, how the pattern of the weather would happen, how the there came a storm, and how bad the storm was. And she was also, she told about these men who did it, how I think it was three guys who went took him out of the courthouse. Nobody reported. Everybody knew who did it, but nothing was done about it. And she said each one of those guys in some way met a violent death. I think one drowned. Another one was shot in a hunting accident. And this other guy who did it was in a bad car accident. And it all happened within maybe a 2-year period after the death of the guy who they took out of jail and hung. That's the most, I think that sticks to me because every time the weather clouds up real bad, being I heard that when I was a child, I think about it, you know. I think about that one.
Do you know when it took place?
This was like in the early, had to be the late 40s.
What other stories about violence or lynchings were you told? What did you hear growing up?
The stories that most of the time we heard that you just have to. When we went to stores, like I said, we stayed in the country. Mm-hmm. And when we would go to town as young boys, my father, he was like I said, he was so protective of us. He was like, you stay in the car and don't get out. And I guess even if white men were standing around, he didn't park in front of them so that we could even have contact with him, you know. And so, you know, like I said, he protected us from a lot of stuff since I can remember. I do remember one incident that happened there in these areas here because we were so far in the country. A lot of people didn't go to town, so you had traveling, you had salesmen who was on the road, people who would fill their cars with candy and flavor for cakes and all kind of little stuff, and they would sell it by stopping from house to house, and they would give credit to the people who they sold stuff to. The year that Dr. King was in Chicago, in March, this man came to our house while we were staying on the association, and sometime he would always like give us a piece of candy or something, you know. So I guess I had that in mind when I ran to his car, and he said that he asked me where was my mother, and I told him she was in Chicago, and he made the statement that you mean to tell me that she's way up there with that Martin Luther King leading them niggas around it? And I was really shocked because I never expected him to say something like that, you know. And I guess my only reaction was to tell him to just go to hell. And when my brothers and sisters who was in the house, when they heard me say something like that, because I had gone to the porch and shouted it back at him, they came rushing out, and I told them what he said. And they like moved around the car, you know, so he backed out. And I guess we didn't think that he could have had a gun or something and very well could have heard us all. But he went back to Marks, this little town, and told my father that we had tried to jump on him. And I guess because he knew that, my father knew the nature of his children. When he came home, he asked us what happened, and we told him what happened, you know, so. So he stopped it. He stopped the guy from coming by the house. He told him to come by there anymore to sell his products, you know, because of that incident. Oh, he just told him not to come back.
I mean, what for job wise?
My father was a farmer, he was a barber, he was a carpenter, he was a mechanic. He did all these things. He made a living doing them all. And so, you know, my father was really a jack of all trades. When we moved to Jonestown in 68, he became the policeman in town. He became the policeman, and he bought that's when he went into the store business. And he bought a grocery store. And that's when things began to look more better then than they had ever looked in my whole life. Because now we had moved to town, we had plumbing and all, and we were in school, me and my brothers, and we were thinking about going to college, and like I said, things, you know, the same type of feeling, I think, that happened last night, you know, people saw, this is a chance for some opportunities, you know, for people to go forward, after the long years of just not being able to do anything. He saw some hope. So that's when he first went into business, and then he continued to be a policeman in town at that time. It was only one. And so, you know, we just began to get up and move, do a few more things than we have been able to do in a long time.
What do you think the election means for blacks?
I'm having not mixed emotion about a black man being president, but mixed emotion about expectations. Mm-hmm. I believe it means that those who get credentials, those who are striving to do something, hopefully, they won't be actually judged by the color of the skin, but by the content of the character. You know, as the dream says, I hope this is that part of the dream. And I hope that people just don't, the ones who are sitting around thinking that, hey, now we're going to be getting something free. I hope they don't buy into that. I hope nobody buy into this feeling that there's going to be a whole lot more stuff given away. I just think the doors that might have been closed during her administration are going to be open during this one. And so I just hope it inspires black, young black guys to become, take care of their families. Inspire them to get back involved in the local church and to be more conscious of the struggle, you know, and it's going to mean so much more for those who are the children who are maybe 3 to 4 years old who are going to grow up seeing a black president, for the unborn who will be born during his presidency. I mean, I can't even imagine their lack of color consciousness that they're going to have, you know, that we didn't have the privilege of having. How much more they'll be able to excel, because they would never feel like they can't do because of the color of their skin, you know. That's the most exciting thing, I think, to come out of this. You have generations coming along who not going to even, you know, you said you're black, they're going to say, you know, like what they got to do with it. And you heard this before, you know, but you just, you know, we always kind of felt like, well, they just don't want to be person who says something like that, don't want to realize that things have happened. They don't want them in black. But I was listening this morning to the Leontine Price on YouTube. I went back to her singing, Lift Every Voice and Sing, and she was making a statement before she began to sing, and she was saying that what she hates most of all is when she goes to a place and people want to be condescending because of the color of her skin. She said, what's that got to do with it, you know? I'm able to excel regardless of my color, you know. I just happen to be this color, but I got the same faculties and everything to work with than anybody else does, you know. And she came from Mississippi. And she was able to, you know, to rise above that color thing to feel that confidence, you know, early. And to me, that's amazing.
What do you think Obama as president will do for white people?
I think Obama will do...
I mean, Obama, as a symbol.
I don't think he's going to do anything as a symbol. I think he's just going to be Obama. I've read his book, you know, and Obama, you know, I think he's pretty much focused on the country as America. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where he's trying to take people to. Trying to bring people to the level where they can see that, you know, like you said, there's no black America, there's no white America, there's the United States of America. And it sounds like a bunch of crap, but that's the way, that's his perspective. And that's the perspective he has because he has black in his family, he has white in his family, and he's embraced his whole family, you know what I'm saying? And so I think that's what we have to do. I embrace the Civil War. You know, I'm not offended by the flying of the Confederate flag. I embrace the Civil War because I have just as much history in the Civil War as I do in World War II and Vietnam conflict. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That's a part of me. And I think once we begin to embrace our differences and once we begin to embrace some of the things that we try to throw out, I think we have a better vision of where we can go. And I think that's what Obama's going to do. He's not going to do anything symbolic for white people or symbolic for black people. I think he's going to work to be the president of the United States. And I think that if you are ready to embrace the vision of this being the United States as written in the Constitution, and realize that that during the time that the Constitution was written, those founders knew that we hadn't evolved to the point that the words of the Constitution says, but they knew that it would come a day. And so I think that's what he's talking to the generation that's evolving. I was stuck in the 60s for a minute, and my son helped me to come out of it. To realize that there is a generation that is not prejudiced. There is a generation of whites and blacks who don't see color like I do. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of us older blacks have come to that realization in the last few months. I think Jesse Jackson has come to it. You know, I think Al Sharpton has come to that realization. Because these people are saying that there is a generation of change that is taking place. And that's what I'm excited about. I'm excited about the evolution of ideals and philosophies and people and technology that is taking place. That we don't have to hold people back because we have fears of they're going to touch my daughter, they're going to marry into my family. That we can just let people just blend and just be stronger, you know. And I'm excited about that. And you're going to still have some old guard who don't want it to happen. You know, but when it's time for something to happen, you can't hold it back. Nobody can hold back Obama now, being president of the United States. It was time. I had a guy come in the store, a white guy come in the store. He told me that Obama is a Muslim. That's why I'm not going to vote for him. I said, okay, you got to take it real slow. and this is going to be therapeutic for you. I want you to say, I want you to let it come out your mouth. Say, oh, I'm not going to vote for Obama because he's a nigga. Say it. I said, say it. He said, I'm not going to say that. I said, but if you say it, it'd be therapeutic because you can finally realize why you're not going to vote for him. I said, even if he was a Muslim and he's qualified, what difference does it make? You know, I mean, if you heard Colin Powell, you know, it don't make a difference. I said, but what you got, you still see him as being a black man, and you can never allow yourself to vote for what you consider as a nigga. When you're away from around me, that's what you call him. So, I mean, just say it around me. I've been knowing you all my life. You've been knowing me. I know you. He, when he never said, he bought a, one of the t-shirts that I had in the store. And, you know, and I think that's what it is, you know. A lot of the guys who've been raised prejudiced, who've raised, and they heard that in their home. Niggas on welfare. Niggas are lazy. Niggas don't let them in your, you know, they constantly heard that that's the way they were orientated. And so, my orientation of fear, your orientation of distrust has caused us to never meet and never understand one another. And we've been raised right in the same environment all our lives. I've never been to your house, you've never been to mine. Because we see each other on the basis of color of skin, you know. And so we've never got a chance to know each other because we were always afraid of one another. We never trusted one another. And that's a shame that we had to be raised like that. You know, people were raised in the same town, so to speak. And so I think that people are going to be able to overcome a lot of those fears, a lot of those things that kept them thinking crazy, you know, during this time now. I really do.
What do you remember about the civil rights movement?
Oh, it was wild, man. You know, people were marching. They had the Freedom Riders coming to town. Remember the Freedom Riders? When they came to Jonestown, registered people
really?
To vote. Yeah, I remember the day I registered to vote. And I remember I remember Dr. King came to Clarksdale. You know, he didn't come to Jonestown, but he came to Clarksdale. And so, I remember all that. You know, I was more into the violent side during the civil rights movement. I was waiting on the revolution. I thought Dr. King was crazy. I didn't want nobody hitting me. I was standing with the, I was listening to the Last Poets, wearing my town, and I wanted to be a Black Panther. That's how I was waiting. I was the average Cleaver side of the civil rights movement. You know, there was three sides. I felt like it was Dr. King, then you had your Black Panther Party, then you had your group who were becoming nation and going into the Nation of Islam. Mm-hmm. And so the Nation of Islam was saying we want a whole state. Dr. King was saying, well, we just want to be treated equal. And the Black Panther was saying we just ready to fight. And I just always felt like it's time to fight. I mean, during that time, that's where I felt. You know, I was into the more radical aspects of the civil rights movement. That was my point of reference. And that's why I felt like I wanted to be.
Why?
Because the anger was there, you know. And not understanding it was anger. Not understanding that you can never take anything by force. Not understanding that nonviolence as power. I couldn't see nonviolence as having any type of power. How can you be empowered by letting somebody hit you upside your head? Or them sticking dogs on you? I didn't see the spiritual essence of nonviolence. Nonviolence made no sense to me. it didn't make sense. And so I couldn't comprehend it until I was much older. Then I could see. I saw that this was, out of all the moves that were made, or all the steps that came into fruition, all of them came because of the nonviolent movement. You know, we can't point to anything that was established by the Nation of Islam, or anything that was established by the Black Panther Party. Would you look at the nonviolent movement? All the laws that were passed because of the nonviolent movement. And so you come to the conclusion that the nonviolent movement was more of the, as you listen to Dr. King's speeches, is all about love. Love your enemy. Love those who despitefully misuse you, you know. Pray for those who curse you, you know. It don't seem like there's no power in it, but there's power there. Because when you do it that way, you bring into, as Dr. King said, you bring into play the elements, you know, God's power, the wind, the sun, the moon, everything. You bring everything into play because you bring God to your side. And so you have at your disposal every weapon that God has to fight a person, when in all the other methods you're only fighting yourself. And that only can lead to destruction.
But you don't think that part of the success of the civil rights movement might have been due to the fact that there's this threat of, like, more violent movements that, I guess, made the white establishment more amenable to the civil rights movement?
I think the move, you said, what now? The progress that was made?
Mm-hmm.
I think it happened because people began to realize the same coalition of people now, who voted yesterday for Barack Obama, realized that this is not what this country is about. I think you have people, white people, who realize that this is not what this country is about. This is not my America. This is not the America I want to raise my child in. You know, if they can do it to me, they can do it to gays, they can do it to anybody. They begin to treat me like this, they can treat my child like this. They can treat a gay person like this. They can treat a woman like this, you know. And so the whole movement for rights, I think, began to make progress. People began to make sense of who they were. That I don't have to believe everything my father or my mother told me while they were raising me. They could have been wrong. You know what I'm saying? People began to realize my mother could have been wrong. My dad could have been wrong. You know, maybe he was just so raised by his own father in such a weird way that he didn't realize he was wrong. Now, I don't have to accept all his values. That's what I'm saying. My son let me know, I don't have to accept your values. Then it made me realize some of my values were wrong, you know. I don't have to be, I mean, I wasn't right just because I'm thinking I'm right. And I'm going to force all my thinking on somebody else. He let me know I can think for myself. And there are shifts. And each generation, when if you don't shift with them, with the generation, then you're going to be stuck in a train of thought where it ain't really a reality. It's your reality, but it's not reality. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be stuck in a non-reality reality.
So what hopes do you have for, I guess our generation?
Well, your generation, I just hope that you guys don't go back to the methods that you see that were wrong to try to build the America that you want for your children. And I hope that you would see the importance of education. I hope you'll be patient with those who didn't understand what was going on in their life, you know, when certain privileges were issued out, and you know, you look at some people, you wonder why they don't excel like others do. I hope that you'll be able to understand their world and their perspective, what has happened to them, and to be patient with them, and to work with them, you know, to kind of understand them a little more, and to like I say, become that generation of servants who are actually willing to help us get out of this mode of greed and excess that this country has gotten into, you know. A lot of the people came off these plantations. We were so close then. If you needed milk, you came to the house next door. If you needed sugar, you came to the house next door. So many times when we got ready to sit down to eat a dinner, there was neighbor kids at the table with us who were eating dinner. And when we began to move to town and we began to enjoy some of the privileges that had been that we couldn't enjoy all of those years that we were held down, we began to act like the same folks who were holding us down. We began to act like the oppressor. And somehow the greed and the pride took over where there was love. A lot of the values we left behind because we didn't feel like they were necessary. It became baggage. We should have held on to those values. You know, I was just excited about going to school 2 days as more excited about going to school 2 days a week than these kids are going to school 5 days a week. I worked with books that didn't even have covers on them. When I would walk a mile just to find out what the lesson going to be the next day. Then to go to school and sit there and feel dumb. I didn't want to do that. You know, when I finished 8th grade, I was an honor student. When I finished high school, I was an honor student. You know, I wanted to excel. And there was a desire to excel. And I just see something happen to that desire as parents began to give their children and not tell them, you know, how about the struggle. Not to just to relive the struggle, but to let them know that these things aren't easy, you know. And I think that's one of the things that our generation didn't do enough of, you know. I have a son and a daughter. My daughter's in Atlanta. My daughter's teaching school in Atlanta. She's 12 hours from finishing her doctorate. My son practices medicine in Tunica County. I didn't give them everything they wanted. My son, my daughter, she knew that I was going to take care of her needs in school. My son always knew that you're going to make it on your own. And I mean, I it's not that I didn't want to help him, but I wouldn't have helped him. But I never wanted him to think that I was going to make a way for you to go to school. Mm-hmm. There's money out here for you to have. If you're smart enough and you get the grade, somebody's going to give you some money to go to school. He's talking about, well, it's a loan. Well, you worry about how you pay it back. And that's what he did. He finished school at Jackson, at Tougaloo. He's the president of the student body. He went there from Jackson State for a year and a half to got a degree in chemistry. He got accepted at Michigan State. He finished med school. And he did this on his own.
Wow.
He did this on his own. Because he knew that he had to have the drive, he had to reach down in there and get it. And so, you know, he was on his own. It's not that I wanted him to be a man. Not that I didn't want to help him. But I knew that he could do it. Mm-hmm. And I knew I had to let him know that he could do it. And so now, you know, he feels good that I let him do it. You know, I never made things easy for him.
So what do you think are some of the problems facing the youth in Jonestown?
There are many, 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 many generational issues that we have. You know, you think about what I just showed you. Years and years of forced ignorance, and these are the children of those who that ignorance was forced upon. And so it's like you got progress to be made. There's so much potential, but then it's there's no direction sometimes. There's no direction. And so, you know, that's what kind of scares you when you see all this potential and no direction. Young children who are the products of these farm people, you know. And sometimes they look so lost. Sometimes they look so lost because they are.
Hey, Obama, when you close up.
Yes, yeah, I do that. Because they don't see the struggle. You know, they don't see the struggle. They're selling themselves out cheap because of the. I won't say the music they're listening to, but I'll just say that they have. They just not realized how important it is, you know, to do something with their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the saddest thing about what I see happening in Jonestown. Another thing they have to see that there's nobody's coming here to do anything for us. Whatever you have to do in Jonestown, we have to do it for ourselves. And what I mean, don't look for the government. Don't look for any type of miracle. You know, be about saving your own community. Be about doing some things here yourself. You know, I came back here. I left a job to come back to Jonestown. I knew the sacrifices I was making to come back and run a business. I knew the sacrifice. Businesses that had been up until 1980, most of the businesses in Jonestown have been owned by Chinese. And Jewish families that came here. And so the banks were leaving, there was no money to be borrowed to start a business. If you start your business, you were on your own, you know. And so I knew the sacrifice I was making. I knew the mentality of the people, you know. This was a mentality in the area where if you had a black business, then people always felt like, hey, somebody else's sugar is always sweeter, somebody else's ice is always colder. So you have to convince people that I can run a business, that I can take care of you just like anybody else can, but I'm not giving stuff away. That people are so used to getting credit. I pay you Friday or they pay on the first of the month. That's the way they've been orientated. And so, you know, all this orientation passed down generation to generation. You have to realize what you're working with, you know. And people have to realize that, you know, I need to be able to walk in my store. You need to be able to walk in my store just like you walk in Walmart. You walk in Walmart, you're not going to walk out there telling the man, I'm going to bring your money back. You pay for what you get, and you leave it. And so that's the same thing I expect. And so why shouldn't I expect it out of you also? You know, I have one store. Walmart got 1,000 stores. If they can operate on that principle and expand, and why should I be able to operate on the same principle? Cash as you go. Why you got to feel like like I'm not helping you because I'm not giving you stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that bothers me most of all, that mentality there.
Where does that mentality come from, do you think?
I think it comes from those years and years of paternalism. The plantation, when people, they actually took care of you. They make you feel like you stay here free on the plantation.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to pay rent, even though the house is raggedy. And you can see straight through it. You don't have to pay rent. I furnish you some money. I take care of you. And so those years of paternalism led to that mentality. And generation to generation have kind of kept it going, perpetuated that mentality. And so unless it stops, at some point, it has to stop.
So one last question. How much internalized depression do you think is still existing in people here?
Plenty. 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 So much. I mean, I think, and plus, it's unknown. You know what I'm saying? People don't know that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't know why. They feel a certain way. They don't know why. They deal with issues the way they do. They don't realize that's exactly what it is, internalized depression. Oppression, yeah. Don't realize that's what it is, you know. And if they come to grips with what it is, I believe they can work with it. But a lot of times they don't know what it is. They don't realize it. This comes from my generation. I've seen brilliant children, children who are brilliant. But because of the families they come from, there had been no one before them to finish college who felt like, because the rest of the children in the families were saying, you think you're better than us, you think you're too smart. They would quit school, have babies, and this is what they do. They don't break the cycle. And I think that's the thing that happens, you know, they don't break the cycle. We began to break the cycle in my family, I think, back in 68. My sister went off to Jackson State, and she was the first one to finish college. And now, you know, my nieces and nephews, they know that's expected of them, you know, 40 years later to finish school, about to go to college or to go even higher than 4 years of college. You know? And my children, I told them, when they talk about quitting school after 4 years of college, you know, that's unacceptable. I got more than that. You're going to come to where I came to. You know, my daughter, she's smart, but she's lazy. She don't even want to finish her doctorate. You know, she just finally told me, I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it on my own time. And I told her, she's always been hard-headed. You could have had it done 10 years ago. And I just told her the same thing I said, that when things began to open up under the president, and you don't have the credentials, don't go crying to me about what you should have done. You know, when things open up, you're going to need everything you got to be able to walk into some of these jobs paying the money. And I just think you owe it to yourself to be able to walk in and make you $150,000 or $200,000 because you got the smarts, you know what I'm saying? And so don't play yourself cheap because you still feel like you're missing out on a party or two. You know, she's 34 years old. She don't have children. She's buying a house. She's doing good. But don't stop there. Keep trying. Keep striving, you know. And like I said, you know, because the next generation has to look further. And so, you know, you have to break the cycles. And so, you know, some of them never break the cycles. This young lady come here, for instance, she come out of a family of women who I think probably finished high school. And see, if nobody helps her, she's going to lose her. She's going to be on the streets too, doing that for the rest of her life. You know? And I see it happen to so many of them around here. You know, we never make it out because they just don't. After a while, they stay around so long, they don't feel comfortable going anywhere else. You know, you run across some of these young people around here, they're talking to you, and the time you walk up on them, they're quiet because they don't feel comfortable. Out of the element. You know, you stay in this town 10 days a week and don't go anywhere. And when you go somewhere, you don't feel comfortable because you're out of your element. So this becomes your world. Mm. And I tell them all the time, you get your globe and just look at the whole world and see where you have limited yourself to. One little spot. And that's where you put, and that's where that, and you think this is it. And all you're doing is listening to music, and that's what you're feeding yourself, the music and the drugs and the alcohol and everything else. I mean, you're building an illusion of a reality, you know, and that's all, a lot of them have that. And that's my biggest fear for people around, young folks around here, that they won't push themselves to do more. And you have to push yourself, you know. Talked to a film last night, you know, some guys feel like, hey, man, I'm going to do better now. I got to step my game up, you know. This year has proven to me that I got to step. And I hope they feel like that. But, you know, you ain't going to be able to do it. You sitting around here drinking a six-pack and smoking blunts all day. You know, you're going to step your game up. You got to leave that stuff alone and get into some books, you know, and study and make some sacrifices. Work two jobs and go to school and do what you got to do. You know, tell me you can't do it all. You just got to do it. You got to do it. You know, you miss right here and got three kids. Some of these guys right here, man, got three kids already, 22 years old, got a job making minimum wage. What can you bring home? How much money can you bring home with that? and they taking out child support. And you mean tell me you're going to settle for this? I can't see it. You know. I said, well, I'm going to quit work. They taking all my money. I mean, what good that going to do? Now you can't have driver's license. They're going to take your driver's license, Nick. So they're throwing you back into this world where you're never going to be able to escape. They can't see the trap that they build for themselves, you know. And that's the saddest thing about it.
Why do they make these illusions?
Huh?
Why do they, use drugs and alcohol and music and?
Because it takes them out of there. You know, when you can't escape, then you build you escapes, and the drugs and alcohol allows you to escape your reality, you know. And that's why you stay high. So you won't have to deal with what's real. And so that's why they do it. Because if they didn't get high, they have to deal with what's real. And they have to actually see that situation. And a lot of them don't wanna deal with it. They don't wanna deal with it. A lot of these guys right here still staying with their parents, they're never gonna be. Right now I am, yeah, I'm coming. You're never going to be able to leave home because, like I said, they can't afford to. And things like that. And so those are the fears that, those are the things that bother me about a lot of the progress. We've come so far, yet we have so far to go. And it doesn't have to be like that because people, you know, can still aspire if they want to, you know. They still can. To move forward.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I think I've talked enough today. Like Forrest Gump said, what did he say? I'm tired now. I think I want to go home.
Is Fred stop on this thing? Yeah.